maneuver.
So the idea is to do it until you're just kind of.
And vape shops.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order on, for February 21st, 2017. Colleagues, we have an information meeting on marijuana tax administration and three different agencies to report on it. Mazen is going to give us a very, very short introduction, and then we're going to hear from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the little history about the marijuana administration. As you're all aware, that Measure 91 legalized the sale and use of marijuana. However, it had a whole different way of doing things. The 2015 session came and primarily rehauled or overhauled the work on how to regulate and how which agency does what. And part of that is that they put the regulation section or regulation job to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and they are the ones who actually holding the body of the regulation and how this product is regulated, sold in the stores, and so on. Now, that's what they probably will give you an idea of how they are doing with that. And then the tax collection and the revenue that comes in from the sale, the point of sale taxation that was changed also by the 2015 from the harvest tax will be administered and is administered by the Department of Revenue. So that is what the Department of Revenue will give you on how their general trends are and what they're looking and what are they doing in order to collect this tax. And then DCBS was mandated by House Bill 4094 to look into the issue of banking for the industry and the impediments for those banking that they will come and update you, give you the report on that House Bill 1494 that they have done.
Very good. Thank you. So let's hear from OLCC. Gentlemen, thank you for coming today.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and with me is Bill Schutte, our economist. We're going to go through a little bit about just what we've done very briefly in terms of sort of the numbers of licenses that we've accomplished over the, I think, 2 years since we've been before your committee, and then go through some of the market data as it's developing with the end of the Early Start program at the end of this year so you can see what we're experiencing. With that...
Chair, committee, for the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I want to just go through a few stats on what we've done, as Director Marks outlined. Between September 15th and January 27th, we approved approximately 600 licenses. As of the February 1st, we had almost 831 approved. That's dated now. As of today, we have about 942 licenses approved in the state of Oregon, including 341 retailers, which is about the same amount as we're selling under the Early Start for the medical dispensaries. I will point out that in our 2015-17 budget, we originally estimated 1,000 applications and 800 licenses. We are getting about twice that many. Here you see a map of the locations, a big cluster in southern Oregon, primarily grow operations, cluster around the metro areas, and big open expanses in eastern Oregon with a few exceptions of towns like Sumter and Huntington, which did allow marijuana, but most of the counties have opted out of that. So a little bit about our original estimate. We came in, based our original estimate on 1,000 applications from based on Washington and Colorado. As of today, with 2,100 applications, we have exceeded both Washington and Colorado. And then when you look at the accounting for the population, we are accepting applications at almost twice the rate as Colorado and Washington. So significantly higher workload than we expected and was seen in the other states that legalized marijuana.
Now, excuse me, these are applications for what?
These are applications for everything, for growers, producers, wholesalers, and retailers.
Okay. Will you have a breakdown later?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Well, okay. Back here are the applications based on the types of licenses.
Mm-hmm. Ah, thank you.
Yeah.
That was what that means. All right.
As Director Marks outlined, we started licensing our first retail operations in October of last year. The end of early start came in January 1st, and full retail operations are regulated by the OLCC. You see a significant increase in sales at that point. Right now, we are selling about $7 million a week in marijuana through our retail outlets. Just as a reference, that was about the same as under the early start as well. And then a caution out there that if the $7 million a week sales continues, we could expect to see $54 million in taxes just alone based on a 17% tax rate in the next year alone. So we might want to be looking again at the forecast for that. So, you know, the sales are much more robust than we thought as well. These are the total sales by week by consumer versus patients. Medical patients with cardholders are allowed to purchase through our retailers, and again, it shows the same ramp up after January 1st, where primarily retail sales, but also medical patients are using our outlets as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, and if you don't have a guess, you don't have to give one, but thank you for being here. I'm kind of surprised by the patient jump being as significant as it is, given that this was a long-established program here. I don't think it's any easier now than it ever was, and with the prevalence just in the recreational market, do you have theories as to why, besides the obvious because they don't have to pay tax when it's medical? Or sorry, did I just give that away?
Chair Barnhart, Rep. Smith-Warner. So a lot of those are retail locations that were medical dispensaries that have converted to our locations. So the consumers that are still going there, customers are going to the same place they did before and purchasing their medical product from virtually the identical location. So that's why we're seeing about, whatever it was, Bill said 12% or whatever of medical sales happening there. Does that answer your question?
Not quite. I more meant that just the numbers going up in the amount on the patient side. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the chart, not just the recreational is going up, but the patient is going up pretty significantly as well. Is it just the tax? I mean, you may not have a guess.
Yeah, I guess the chair representative, we don't have a really good answer for that, although as Director Marks alluded to, they are used to going to these outlets, and so they're continuing to go to these outlets. There are a significant amount of growers out there, patients that are not associated with a grower. They're just standalone patients, and this is where they have opted to go and get their medical marijuana.
Maybe if I may. So maybe if they're going to a store where they used to just be able to get medical stuff and now there's other stuff too, perhaps that is increasing their sales as well?
Yes.
Okay.
I agree with that.
Representative Marsh?
Thank you, Mr. Crutcher. What happened at the beginning of January, do you think? Why did we get this huge jump here in both users?
Chair Representative Marsh, at the beginning of January was the stop of the early sales that was through medical dispensaries primarily, and the beginning of our recreational market OLCC licensed stores. And these are just representative of the stores that OLCC is licensed, and most of them came online on January.
Oh, okay.
A few were on before January.
Yeah, that's right.
Who here was on the joint committee last time?
The joint committee?
Yes. Just Representative Johnson?
Representative
Benz.
Marijuana? Oh, sorry.
The marijuana committee.
No.
I don't think anybody.
No? Talking about JTACs. No, I wasn't on the marijuana.
You weren't on the marijuana committee. Anybody here? So none of us have the background that you are very familiar with when it comes to these issues. So as you go along, you might kind of fill us in on the pieces that the members of that committee, of course, are enormously familiar with, but which is an issue of first impression for us.
Right.
Yeah. We'll do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I know Revenue has a detailed sort of history behind the creation of the program.
Is that in OLS?
Department of Revenue is coming.
Oh, the Department of Revenue is coming next. Okay. All right. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
Next is a sale of a progressive sale of marijuana type products by product type, usable marijuana versus extracts versus edibles and tinctures. Again, the same scale up for both of those, indicating that as they converted to our system, not just one type of product, but all type of marijuana products were absorbed in our retail system. And this is the market share by the types of products that are being sold. The blue area is usable marijuana. Usable marijuana is the stuff you smoke, basically, flower and bud, followed by the green area, which are extracts or concentrates. Some people know them as hash oil that are used to put in edibles, but also used in what they call vaping. And then also edible and then smaller amount of plant types, plant sales and that sort of thing. These results are pretty consistent with Colorado and Washington. This is the distribution of types of sales that those states also see as well. And just again to talk about that, the different types of products all scaled up very similarly. Usable marijuana scaled up again with the early start and the transition to our retail outlets. Again, doing about $4.5 million a week just on the leaf and bud sales. Same with the concentrates, and again, the same with the tinctures and the edibles. There were some lumps in the road there when lab testing became a little bit restricted, but hopefully we have gotten past that, and now we have sales that are all types of products that are being tested in the market. And to the question of the medical sales, total sales through the 1st of February were about $46.8 million. Of those, 13% were by medical patients. And again, the estimated tax of the 1st of February, based on a 17% tax rate, is $6.9
million. So just moving forward, and Bill talked a little bit about, we had some constraints on moving product to market with some difficult testing regulations in place. We've just brought up a number of new labs to test products of all types, and you know, constraints in getting labs certified and their throughput in terms of the numbers of tests they could get done and the new methodologies that were put in place sort of delayed growth of the OLCC market for some time prior to early start, ending at the end of the year. We continue in the governor's office, OHA, Department of Agriculture, and us continue to work on that. The Oregon Health Authority has primary responsibility for the testing issues just as we go forward. On compliance, this goes to, I think, system stability, because you have to have an interest in continuing stability of the revenue flow from this. We have had some experience where our tracking system, our cannabis tracking system, where we've had some non-compliance. We've sent out a letter to about 140 growers, and they need to track their plant and all along the production line. They track the product movements and the weights and the packaging. 20% of our licensees were not properly reporting. And some of that's understandable. It's a little difficult system. We've worked hard to get people into it, but 80% of them have done quite well with it. Of those, a lot of the ones with noncompliance happen to be in the grow community. But since the time, a week and a half ago roughly, that we put out the guidance, we've already got 77 of those 140 licensees into full compliance. Mm-hmm. So we're down to about a 10% issue, so that's good. But, you know, there's some alertness there about the ability of our licensees to maintain production here. So I wanted to alert you to that. And we're working closely with them to bring everyone into full compliance.
Are you suggesting that they may not be able to meet demand?
No.
That's not a different issue.
They're not actually technically tracking the marijuana at the points they need to and the timing they need to do it under the rules.
Great. Thank you.
So licensing and Bill's first chart gave you an idea of the tidal wave of license applications we had. We got double the work. We were funded on a staff level to approximately do 800, 1,200 licenses. We're right about, you know, nearing that 1,000 mark, a little under. But we get that done. It's been a lot of work. We've put all of our staff, a lot from the alcohol program and a lot from the enforcement part of the marijuana program, onto this task of getting licenses out the door, working on the education and the compliance issues. We're now having to turn and move into enforcement mode. So we're going to back some of the staff out of that process. So I expect that our rate of licensing will slow down a bit. We're going to try to double fill some of that to maintain the rate, but I think we will carry, you know, that extra 1,000. You know, I'm hopeful that by the end of the biennium, we will have, you know, roughly half of that license. But that's just our rate of licensure is going to change here a bit over the coming months. Of course, we got budget proposals going forward. Our budget is based on, we're funded by the license revenues, so it's a capitated system. We'll get revenue growth within the agency with these new licensees. So we just need in the next biennium to get some FTE associated with that revenue, and we should be able to do it. We've had discussions both with LFO and DAS in our budget preparation. Everyone's looking for that next part of the forecasting on revenue and looking at our budget to make sure that we get the resources that we need to move forward. Legislative changes. The biggest change in front of everyone is whether OLCC takes on licensing of all kinds of grows, including those traditionally in the medical system. We'll be reporting the Joint Marijuana Committee this evening on a proposal for them to consider. There are several pieces of legislation that would seek to accomplish the same thing. So that's going to be interesting because there are a whole lot of registered growers in the medical system, about 37,000, Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, medical registered growers. So we'll take a look at that and work with the Joint Committee on it, but that involves making sure that the supplies of marijuana that we create, that we don't drain the supply of medical marijuana for medical patients. That's a concern here as they lose their retail or their dispensaries move into our system. So people are looking at how can we do that licensing, but then assure that those medical patients have access to the kinds of products that they expected to, that they did traditionally get and expect to get in the medical system. So with that, our last slide is, since we've been here last, our mission has changed. We have incorporated in our mission to support businesses, public safety, and community livability through the education enforcement of liquor and marijuana laws. So that's a big change for the program, and we're moving forward under that new mission. With that.
Questions? Representative Smith?
Thank you. Can we go to the map on the recreational marijuana location? There you go. Can you share with us? I see a couple dots there on the far eastern Oregon part of the state. Whose house district is that?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, I do not know the answer.
I think it's Representative Bence's House District 60. Representative, share with us a little bit about your constituents. Do they prefer the bud, the oil, the edibles? Tell us about your folks.
Right now, we're asking questions of the OLCC.
Okay. I got confused.
Question is out of order.
I'm sorry. I'm just curious about his folks there.
One of the things you can say about Representative Bent's district is that it is so large that any dot on the map is more likely to fall in his district than in any other. Representative Marsh and then Representative Bueller.
Well, my district is one of those with that's just, you can hardly see the county there for all the little red dots. We call it the land of weed and wine down there. But I have a different question for you. How, which you may or may not have any a sense of, but how effectively do you think that we are pursuing human resources law with people in terms of workers' comp and payroll deductions and all the restrictions that go on an industry when you're moving into the legal format.
Rep. Barnhart, Representative Marsh. So OLCC hasn't had responsibilities in those areas, so I guess say we've been paying less attention to them than other things because we've been pretty busy. However, we have had sort of the business side and educational groups working at times as we move forward. We had a business advisory committee looking at insurance and all of those issues across the spectrum. I think, you know, if you talk to the industry, the highest number one issue is banking. If you could bank this, that would take the cash out and I think create or help alleviate some of the most serious public safety issues that we have. It's just having a lot of cash on site.
And we'll hear about that in a minute.
Yeah. We do have a business readiness guide. I'll get that to you. It kind of gives you a full spectrum of the kinds of regular business issues that the marijuana community has, just like any other small business. Mm-hmm. So they're all out there. So it's important that you consider those things as a legislature.
Thank you, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. Steve, how do you explain the double rate of marijuana license per population compared to culturally pretty similar states? Is it excessive supply or excessive demand driving that?
Chairman Rep. Bueller, I think it's our culture. I mean, we have what, you know, Washington didn't have the outdoor grow culture that Oregon has had for a very, very long time as strongly. Colorado certainly doesn't have that. So I think we've got some depth in our system that other states haven't. That's a part of it. We are actually different culturally in terms of the other states. But I can't fully explain that. Bill, I don't know if you've seen
Chair, Representative Bueller, there are a couple differences between Colorado and Washington and Oregon. Colorado at first required vertical integration, which means a retailer had to be related to a wholesaler, had to be related to a grower. So the companies had to be vertically integrated before they could apply for licenses. Second difference is that the state of Washington initially put a cap on the number of retail outlets. That has since been lifted. But still, despite all that, the great majority of licenses, almost half of them in all states, including Oregon, are grow operations.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I have a serious question this time. If I recall, when the program was first starting, the OLCC on the liquor side loaned this side, I think it was about $8 million. Have those dollars been repaid?
So, Chairman Rep. Greg Smith. So that money is available to be repaid. Department of Revenue will tell you about the procedures we need to get through there. I'm sure they'll tell you that there's ways I think you could speed up the repayment process. One of the things that hasn't occurred is we're not at the end of the biennium, so we haven't reconciled our costs fully. So, you know, you could estimate that difference. There's also some complexity here that they'll talk about in terms of there were opt-in and opt-out and opt-in. Well, your formula changed depending on where you were with those things, and we're working with the Department of Revenue is working with AOC and LOC to work with them to certify their status now and what their laws have done, but that's a little complexity with the formula that's challenging Department of Revenue as well.
Thank you.
But I might add, the nice thing when that repayment comes is, of course, we'll just move that right through to the monthly payments on the liquor side. So that'll all come into the formula right away.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is interesting looking at that map. I think it's reflective of how people voted.
For 97.
One of the things that is of interest is that dot that's in Huntington. There's been quite a change because of the huge migration of folks from Idaho into Oregon. And so a little town of 200 has been dramatically affected, not necessarily positively, by this program. If you talk to the people that live there, they would suggest that no one would want to raise their kids there because every third house now is a retail outlet for people coming in from Idaho. Not necessarily a positive thing for the community. So I'm not sure that your report really addresses that, and perhaps we're going to hear more about it. But there is no doubt that that impact has not been positive, unless you were trying to sell your house, in which event you've been successful. But I'm just saying, it's quite interesting to look at these numbers, but it's also interesting to look at the other side of it.
Vice Chair Benson, you know, they put together a petition in front of the commission to expand some canopy size, so the commission is going to be looking at their issues there specifically, and obviously because it's on the border, there is a lot of concern.
I just mentioned that when I was doing a tour there with the speaker, who very, very kindly came over to look at this area, or my area, for 3 days during the summer. We actually stopped in Huntington and had lunch. And I think the indication was from one of the store owners there was that they had 360 visitors a day to his store.
Wow.
And so that's, since Huntington has a population of 200, I'm guessing there was somebody from out of town visiting the store. So it's a problem. So I'm glad you're looking at it.
And for your background of the committee, the Cole Memorandum, which provides guidance to states and sort of what federal regulators, very ephemeral guidance to states, but the only guidance to states on what we do. Obviously, diversions out of state commerce is something that is entirely frowned upon by that guidance.
It's one of the six or seven guidances that are contained in that memorandum, isn't it?
Yes, very specifically. No, it's very specific.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a relationship between the number of production licenses that are issued and the volume of sales in the state, i.e., do we look at the relationship between demand and supply so that we're not creating more supply than consumers have demand for, so we're producing excess supply that doesn't just simply stay within the confines of our cozy beaver state here?
Chair Barnhart, Rep. Johnson, our system created requires us to look a little bit of supply, but doesn't tell us to limit change the way we license. So we get a bit of a market-driven approach to supply, and that if your qualifications-based, if you meet the qualifications, OLCC will license you. So, you know, you can anticipate that in our industry there will be, in this license structure, there will be a shakeout in the community without controls on supply. And we've seen Washington went the other way. They started off, you know, with a lottery to the population, and now they've opened it up. We've opened it up, and the market forces are ultimately going to be correcting that. And that causes me some concern as director of OLCC, because I think that puts some pressure on some diversion issues as that happens.
Thank you.
Follow-up?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Yes. What leads to that question, I think I remember tuning into some of the early marijuana hearings when the committee was working in the last session, and there was someone at OSU that actually was saying, that tracks this closely, was saying that the old medical marijuana growing establishment we had in the state produced more than enough that the state would be able to have need for on the retail side already without adding all of these other licenses that we've added in the system since. And I know there's just a lot of interest in that, but I guess as a representative, I'm still wondering, are we still creating product for export?
So, Chairman Barnhart, Rep. Johnson, there's no doubt the system produces a lot of marijuana. We'll be working on making some scenarios about production. There's a lot of argument about the number of production. No one has the rocket science on nailing it down, but we do have indications from Washington and Colorado on sort of their average yield and number of plants, and we know the cardholders. So I think we're going to work with the Joint Committee to give them a production estimate, but with all the medical registered growers out there, I think you can assume that there's plenty to export.
Thank you.
And Chair Representative Johnson, I just add that as part of House Bill 3400, OLCC is required to issue a report every 2 years on supply and demand. So we will be looking at that as well.
Thanks.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the shakeout, and there's a lot of dispensaries in my district. I think it's just all red, right next to Gnosis.
and Geyers.
And a lot of what I've heard from these small businesses is that they haven't received their license yet. And I know that some are still waiting. Do you know how many are in the backlog? And if it is a market-driven, these folks are competing against each other, and those that don't have that license may be disadvantaged.
Well, you want to go to the license slide just so. I think roughly there's about 400, 500 retail applications, 560 when you look on there. Of that, we've licensed 312. Most of those were early adopters. They came in, did their work, did it during early start. Some of them were ready to move. Other of them waited till early start ended, December, to begin this process. Takes some time. You got to get your land use permit. So, and we've been taking on new applications literally between October and February and between December and February. You know, we've taken on applications as fast as we can put them out the door. And I just said, you know, I think we're going to be slowing a little bit. Retailers have had a priority for us because we wanted to make sure consumers had a place to go. But I can't, you know, assure you that we're going to march right through every one of those retailers and get them done. But they are a priority. They're easier to license. They have less issues than production at the grow level. It takes us longer. We need a better inspection when we do those than we do for retailers. So we'll do our best to get them out quickly. I think, you know, we've done most of this work over the last 6 months in terms of licensing. And as I said, I'm hopeful that we can get 500 of that 1,000 done before the end of the biennium. But there's work to do there.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And forgive me for returning to this issue again, but it's I think I better put a finer point on it. The challenge, of course, is that Idaho is, in essence, a dry state, and all kinds of folks are coming out of a state that does not did not choose to legalize this particular thing. And as a result, we have all kinds of people coming into these communities, spending the weekend wandering around and basically making life challenging for those who live on the Oregon side. And it's a reflection, of course, of the fact that we're part of Oregon, and when these laws change, the juxtaposition against Idaho is magnified. I guess what I heard you say is, and by the way, it's not just the marijuana laws that have that impact. There's a lot of them. But I heard you say that you're looking into this. Was that just a passing reference, or is something actually going to happen that when I go back home and people from Huntington that actually have to live there because I can't leave? What do I share with them?
So a couple of things. We're looking into anything that has to do with licensing and public safety related to our licensees, but we have no enforcement authority outside of our licensees, only in their interactions. So that was part of the creation of the system. So to the extent that there are law enforcement problems, public use, those don't fall under. The place where it falls back under OLCC regulation is in our bars. Right, and consumption in our bars, which is outlawed, that we don't support. But, you know, in terms of the process of licensing, we don't have any differences in how we look at them, unless they're diverting, unless they're doing something wrong in our system. We have no enforcement powers.
Thank you.
I want to pursue that a little bit. You clearly have a set of rules that you're supposed to follow, or that your retailers are supposed to follow, as to who they sell to. For example, they're not allowed to sell to anybody who's under a certain age. Yeah. My recollection is that's 21.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And is there any restriction on them selling to people who are from out of state? Someone drives into Representative Bent's district with an Idaho license plate, stops in front of the store, goes in, buys the maximum amount they're allowed to buy, whatever that is, and goes out again. Does a retailer have any obligation to inquire about whether that marijuana is going to go out of state or not, and not sell it if it is?
The law is adults over 21, so currently no. The retailers, I think, do have some obligation to consider, you know, whether it's going out for export if they have knowledge of that, but tough showing.
Okay. I assume that one of the issues you're going to be talking to the Joint Committee about is how we take seriously the obligation that we have under the AG's memorandum, including that point about export. I mean, if you're testifying here today that you know that supply is larger than what can be sold in Oregon, then I consider that to be a big problem. It's an important problem. And I assume you're going to be telling the Joint Committee how you're going to how somebody ought to manage that. It may not be your responsibility, but certainly it certainly is our responsibility if we're going to comply with the United States federal requirements on the sale and use of marijuana in the state of Oregon. Is that something that you're working on?
Chair Marner, it was an active discussion during the last session, and it remains an active discussion about, you know, controls within the borders of the state.
I mean, that doesn't fall within the purview of this committee, so I won't pursue it. You indicated a bit ago, just in passing, that there may be some fallout among retailers or producers as a result of the sheer number of operations that there are. I assume that what you meant by that was that you're licensing people as they come along and qualify under the current rules, and if there are six licensees on the same street, five of them are going to go out of business here one of these days because they can't make enough sales to pay their employees. Is that a reasonable way of thinking about this? Or?
Correct, but I would say there's significant opportunity for local regulation in the time, place, and manner around our licensees. So, you know.
Oh, that's the LUCS issue, is it, or is it something?
No, those are regular local time, place, and manner regulations. The land use compatibility statement is
that's
a requirement before we even move into looking at the application.
So the local jurisdictions have the authority to set up to required time, place, and manner rules that you will help enforce by your licensing process. I'm getting a head nod over here. Okay. So that might be an issue for Representative Benz to take home to the counties that he represents, perhaps. I wouldn't want to tell him how to manage the things in that part of the state. This is a concern, I think, to some, certainly is to me personally. So again, it's not part of the jurisdiction of this committee, but if we don't do this right, we should expect that at some point federal government will change the rules if we don't follow them.
Well, they might change them anyway.
They might change them anyway. That's right. I think we'll probably avoid that topic from now. Any other questions for the OLCC? Because we're way behind and we should go on. Thank you so much for your presentation today. We very much appreciate it. Department of Revenue.
And members of the committee for Department of Revenue, there's three pieces in all of the one that talks about the presentation is the presentation down the line in all of us. That is the testimony which has a table of numbers, and then you would have also a research report that they've the research section have done on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And for the benefit of the committee, because I know this material is new to you, I have prepared some an overview, basically, of the marijuana tax program. As you can see in our marijuana report that Mazen just referred to, that our research section produced, page 3, there's a nice timeline that shows when it what happened when. Voters approved it November 4th, 2014. July 1, 2015, folks 21 and older can possess it. It's not available for sale yet. October 1, 2015, marijuana is available for sale through early start locations through dispensaries. This is a great cheat sheet for you. There's two pages of kind of the history of how we got to where we are and the bills that put us to where we are today. So I wanted to point that out to you in this document. Also in the document, which I'm not going to speak to a whole lot, is just the receipts
in the background. We do have that in the other part of the presentation I'm going to present. But I just, the point I want to make about the receipts is that it is just receipts. It is what the tax that the retailer or the medical dispensary collected during the prior month, and then remitted to us during the month that it was due. We did provide, our research section did provide some characteristics of returns that are filed. Generally, we don't go to a specific city location, but because of the unusual quantity in the Portland city limits, we were able to break that down for those folks. You can tell from the map that the OLCC provided. So there's some statistics here too. Because of the confidentiality provisions of the returns, we can't give specific information that would tie to a specific retailer or dispensary. We do aggregate this information. So I wanted to show that to you to be familiar, so you could be familiar with that. And I think this is the other one. So this is my actual presentation, so I'll go over this part now. So the early start provisions that you hear everyone talking about, those were sales through medical dispensaries, and those sales began October 1st, 2015, and ran all the way through December 31st of 2016. There was no tax on the sales from October 1st through January 3rd, because the bill originally, the Measure 91 actually enacted the tax on January 4th. So the early start provisions did not have tax that first quarter. The tax rate on the early start provisions was 25%. That was the state tax. There was no local tax in that point. And the tax is collected at the point of sale. The early start provisions were sold through Oregon medical marijuana program approved dispensaries. And businesses that do collect the tax can remit net to us. They get to keep 2% to offset their administrative costs for the collection of the tax. Beginning this last fall of 2016, in October, the retailers, the licensed retailers through the OLCC, began transitioning from the dispensary type of business to a licensed retailer. The point that they became a licensed retailer, they could start collecting the tax at the 17% state rate and the local 3% rate. So we did have some businesses, like the OLCC said, that chose to stay as a medical dispensary clear up until January 1, when the early start provisions no longer existed. And then we had some that chose to be both, that transitioned during that period. So those folks will be required to file both returns, one for the 25% and then one for the 17% tax rate. The interesting part about the recreational stores is that the medical patients, I believe someone may have already mentioned this, they can purchase tax-free in the retail locations. It's administratively easier to do that for them. It does go back to the conversation that we had about what a tax expenditure is the other day in the committee. Medical marijuana was never intended to be taxed, but we've created an exemption in this so that they don't pay tax in the retail locations. This last year, Senate Bill 1511 authorized the sale of additional products during the early start provisions. So the early start provisions just had limited quantities of marijuana that was able to be sold. It was just a flower, bud, and I think, Mazin, do you remember? I can't remember the other item, but they expanded it to include the edibles, the non-psychoactive topicals, lotions, that kind of thing, and the receptacles, the vape pens, the butane hash oil, that kind of thing. Those sales began June 2nd of 2016. So we did add those products to the early start tax return. We have not been able yet to identify what the makeup of sales are by product. For us, we're working with OLCC to do that from the early start provisions, because early start provisions did not have the same level of tracking that the retail system does. The legalized marijuana, we kind of as we had to put this into place on pretty short notice, we learned that we would be in, managing the tax side of this in May of 2015, and the sales started in October of 2015. We decided to pattern this off of our withholding tax program. So taxpayers are required to deposit monthly payments with us and file a quarterly tax return to reconcile those three monthly payments. Those participants were the filers, and the first part were again dispensaries, and then now today we have retail licensed facilities that are filing online in our new system through Revenue Online. The returns are filed that way. It was paper only under the early start provisions because they were temporary provisions, and we are going through a major core system replacement. Do you have any questions so far before I kind of transition to the banking side of it?
Yeah, we're going to be short of time today, okay. So unless there's something burning, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. So as you probably are all aware, the Controlled Substances Act is what is causing the issue here. Marijuana is still classified as a Schedule I drug, which means there's no medical purpose for it. In August of 2016, the DEA did issue a memo that said that we don't have enough evidence to show that there's a medical purpose for it to be worth moving it down to a different schedule or removing it at all. But they did expand the number of universities in the country that will be able to study and provide data to show that there maybe is some medical issue or medical use for it. The issue is with banking, though, is whether it's on the Controlled Substances Act at all. If our banking partners have told us that as long as it's listed, then for recreational purposes, it's still a controlled substance. And so it might alleviate some of the banking concerns for medical dispensaries, but not for the recreational world. So until we have a federal law change, basically, we have to plan to deal with high volumes of cash. Right now, we have about 60% of the payments that are coming in are about our cash, and we have stepped up our security and ability to take cash in our facility currently. There are in other states, they have more financial institutions that are willing to take to bank these customers than they are in Oregon. We have one community credit union that we know of in the Salem area that is doing it. We've heard rumors of a couple others that are willing to come on board, but we've got no banks that are interested in taking this on until it comes off of the Controlled Substances Act. The fear is that they'll have their FDIC insurance revoked or money laundering charges against them. So we have an infrastructure in place. One of our primary concerns when we did this program was to make sure that our taxpayers were safe and our employees were safe in bringing this kind of cash into the building. We've consulted with casinos and banks, and we consulted with our partner states, Washington and Colorado, on how they administered this. And one of the things that we talked about was definitely scheduling appointments for taxpayers. Taxpayers have to schedule an appointment in advance to tell us how much they're planning to bring in so we can allot the correct amount of time to count that amount of money. We have followed all our internal controls related to counting in double custody. We have the same staff can't be counting the cash that, you know, reconciling it on the back end that received it on the front end. So we have cameras on top of that show the denomination. It zooms in so tight it shows a denomination of some of those bills.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask a question on the Department of Revenue verification side. You know, typically when a financial audit occurs, the auditor will match up tax returns with bank statements to verify, because the deposit slips tend to be a source of verifying what cash was deposited. How are we doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, in the new retail license system, there's a seed to sale tracking system that tracks, and that's a lot of the data that they were able to provide showing that jump in January, that will show us exactly how much is being sold and be able to tell exactly how much should have been remitted. And so we're partnering with them. Now, the early start provisions, that's something different. It's more, we have to do more investigation and working with them to make sure that the returns are calculated correctly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
One of the things that we have considered is that federal rulemaking takes a long, long time. So once we do get something out of off the Controlled Substances Act or some sort of guidance that says these financial institutions can bank these customers in spite of the Controlled Substances Act, it's going to take a long time. So we've got about a 10-year plan. We're envisioning that this will be long-term. So we do have a plan to further step up our ability to handle large volumes of cash. The key thing is that you need to remember, and I think that Representative Marsh may have alluded to this earlier, is that this is not just for this marijuana tax program, but these people employ people. They have payroll taxes. We're enforcing all of that as well through our agency. We're educating. We've gone out and done a lot of outreach to folks. But you also have your peripheral businesses, your service providers, the people who, you know, the attorneys, the accountants that do their books, that kind of thing, that are being paid in cash as well. So this is not just to these so-called canna businesses that are being affected by this.
So utilities, landlords?
Utilities, landlords, yeah.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me ask the question. How are they issuing checks? They can't deposit their cash in an FDIC-backed bank. How do they issue a check to the gas company, to the power company, to their employee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, they bring us cash, and we deposit their cash.
Are we assuming they're paying every one of their bills with cash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that is what some of the things that we're hearing. Yeah, sometimes money orders. Sometimes they do have bank accounts that they just haven't been found yet. We hear anecdotally from our customers that my account has been frozen, and I have to, you know, they're investigating me, and I'm going to have to find a new account. But they open them under other pretenses.
So you're dealing with just other conditions.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, the next presentation will be
more on
this issue. So if we can finish this presentation and move on, we do have two bills we'd like to consider today if we have time to get to them. Representative Bueller?
I was going to ask about the banking issue. So.
Okay. Why don't we hold that for DCBS? See if we can get to that okay. with those. I think if you would stick to the issues that the department has vis-a-vis the cash deposit issues, I think that would be very helpful for us in terms of our time.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move on. The next slide just shows the receipts from the early start provision for fiscal year 15-16. We received almost $21 million. So far, you can see the next slide is just the next month's receipts. And then the newest slide is our January receipts, which were just released today, $5.26 million through January 31st. So for the entire program total, we've received $65 million in receipts since its inception. Our enforcement efforts, we are actively, I think that the OLCC mentioned some of the folks are just not complying because there's some confusion. Same thing with Oregon. They don't realize they also need to file a return. They've made the deposit. They think that that's all that they need to do, but they actually have to file a return to show us what the categories of payments, what category of product that was sold, that kind of thing. So we've done failure to file assessments for first, second, and third quarters, and we've got our fourth quarter demand to file notices going out here in the next week or so. The fourth quarter returns were just due for both the early start and the licensed retailers January 31st, so we're just in that enforcement phase there. The next slides just show the outreach that we've taken, the steps that we've tried to take to show people and explain to people how to comply with this. We do have the business readiness guide that's written in conjunction with OLCC and different agencies on all the things that a business needs to do to come into a legal market in Oregon. We've worked with OHA to send informational letters to the dispensary folks, and we've used listservs, that kind of thing. So we also are working with our local governments to administer the local tax for them. There was a legislative change to allow our statute was amended to allow us to also collect for the marijuana tax. And we worked with the League of Oregon Cities on developing an interagency agreement template so that the cities that want to have us do that are uniform in the way that they're doing the return processing, collection, due dates, that kind of thing. So far, we've got nearly 70 intergovernmental agreements signed with local governments, and we've been collecting since January 1st. This is one of the things that I wanted to spend a little bit more time on just because you guys do have these bills, and I wanted to explain the department's position. on the distribution schedule. As you can see, 40% is going to the common school fund, the distribution schedule here, but the key is the 20% to local governments. The 20% is to the locality distribution. Pre-July 1, distributions made before July 1, 2017 are based on population. Distributions made July 1, 2017 and later are made based on number of licenses in the counties. The key here is that the statute requires that, like Representative Smith said earlier, about $8 million of liquor fund proceeds, or there was a loan from the liquor fund to start up the costs of this program, about $8 million from the OLCC and I think about $3 million from OHA. Those funds have to be paid back prior to us being able to distribute any to any local jurisdiction. So the OLCC can continue to spend, like Director Mark said, through June 30th of 2017. So we have a window between July 1st and September 30th of 2017 to reconcile that and issue distributions to the local governments. That means under current law that the formula that you have based on population wouldn't be effective, wouldn't be put in place, because the distributions will be made after July 1. Probably sometime in later August or even September, once the reconciliation process occurs. So that is part of the issue that local governments have. None of that money that we have sitting here has been distributed to the local governments yet, and it can't under current law until the liquor fund and the OHA has been repaid. Okay. Any questions?
I think we're going to talk more about this when we get to the bills.
And then, so the other thing, we just for information, we've done quite a bit of rulemaking to help folks comply with the program, and that's the slides that are the final slides there. And then this is just a cheat sheet for you to know which department you need to go to for what type of program. Okay, and that's it.
Very good. Thank you so much. You've managed to move us right along. I don't see the senators who are going to be here at 2 o'clock, so I think we'll go ahead then with the Department of Consumer and Business Services report on banking, on cash and banking issues.
2:30.
Sorry?
Senators will be here at 2:30.
Oh, 2:30. I misunderstood. I've been looking at 2 o'clock. Okay.
Well, we'll still be brief regardless.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, and Smith Warner, and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell, Policy Manager with the Division of Financial Regulations, the entity that supervises and examines our financial institutions, state chartered banks and credit unions. To short circuit maybe a little bit, I wish I had a little more definitive answer on how to answer the question of banking cannabis businesses. I think we all recognize that this is a significant issue that we'd all like to address. But unfortunately, we're dealing in an environment that's there's significant federal overlay and quite a bit of uncertainty. So I think against that backdrop, this body introduced and passed House Bill 4094 in the 16th session. The bill actually did three things, only one of which is was related to DCBS. But first, financial institutions that had a little more certainty that they could provide services to legal cannabis businesses. So it relaxed some of the criminal state criminal laws related to areas like money laundering. The second part of the 4094 actually required some information sharing between OLCC, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Oregon Department of Revenue. This is important that banks, financial institutions, when they do their due diligence, need as much information as possible to ensure they know everything about their customer. Having that information sharing in place would certainly help them in making sure that they do their diligence when they open an account for which they know there's maybe a cannabis-related business. Diligence isn't impossible, but it is very difficult. So the final part, which is why we're here, is that the department was to study and identify actions to facilitate the provision of depository and related services. Sorry to read. Basically, though, we were tasked to trying to figure out what options does the state have in making sure that banks had a little more certainty in providing, state chartered banks had a little more certainty in providing services to our legal businesses in the state. We evaluated the Department of Treasury's memorandum on expectations regarding marijuana-related businesses. So this is kind of the companion memo to the FinCEN memo. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network put together a memorandum to discuss how to track and report information related to marijuana-related businesses. This would apply to financial institutions as well as non-bank institutions like money transmitters. And then the bill also required us to identify any legislative or administrative action that we could recommend to the legislature to facilitate the banking of cannabis-related businesses. We put together a work group of with representatives of financial institutions, insurance. Do you want to thank Mazen for his time on the work group as well? The Department of Revenue, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, OHA, Treasury, and at least one non-bank entity that provides or was getting licensed to provide services in Washington State. They're basically a money transmitter that would do essentially SAR after SAR. I mean, they would basically have watch monitor transactions for the companies that they were providing services for. So with that in mind, I'd like to turn it over to Senior Policy Analyst Aaron Tieberbaugh, who was instrumental in drafting the report.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Tieberbaugh. I'm a Senior Policy Analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation. As Ms. Mack had mentioned, the overall conclusion of the work group that we pulled together was that ultimately the problems with banking marijuana-related businesses, it's a matter of federal law, that the federal overlay with the Controlled Substances Act, the Bank Secrecy Act, and other various anti-money laundering provisions just make it illegal for banks to, or technically illegal for banks to serve cannabis businesses. Having said that, the federal government has put out different memos, the FinCEN memo and the Cole memos, that have said, yes, it's illegal, but you can do it if you follow these parameters. That doesn't provide a whole lot of security to the banks and the credit unions who would be wanting to provide these types of services primarily to primary businesses that are directly dealing with marijuana. The guidance so far has only stressed that if you are a financial institution and you're getting money from a marijuana-related business that's actually plant-touching, you can do it if you follow these very specific enhanced due diligence procedures and make sure that the business is complying with the parameters of the Cole memo, which would prohibit leaving state or the actual product leaving the state, selling to minors, implicating gangs and guns and things like that. So what that doesn't provide is any assurance to banks who want to provide provision to secondary providers like the accountants, the lawyers, the landlords. So far, there hasn't actually been any guidance with regard to secondary type businesses. So the recommendations that came out of the committee, the first one was, since this is an issue of federal law, what we need is to join together with some of or all of the other 28 states who have legalized marijuana in some form for either medicine or for recreational purposes and form a coalition to be able to keep the issue alive and press legislation that could either begin treating marijuana like alcohol or begin resolving the tax issues or begin resolving some of the banking issues. So that has started to sort of a small extent. There is a what they call a cannabis coalition that has just started to really push the issue. At this point, it's very small, but they're looking for it is a bipartisan group of representatives, and they are looking for more members because this is something that crosses both sides of the aisle, and with 28 different states, it impacts a great number of states, a great number of businesses, and a great number of people. So the committee also recommended that there be some sort of, beyond a congressional delegation, that the executives of the various states who do have legal marijuana in for medicinal purposes or recreational purposes should also form together and make sure that they can bring the issue to light, to keep the issues to light, and see if we can't move the federal congressional delegation. Shy of action at the federal level, the only other recommendations that the committee really could get behind unanimously was that there be some sort of open communication and support by the state banking regulators to make sure that they could work with the financial institutions and provide specific guidance with what we were looking for in terms of exams, how to meet the Cole memo guidance, how to meet the FinCEN memo guidance. This is something that's proved to be very valuable in Colorado and Washington, where they've done outreach to financial institutions with both state and federal regulators to open lines of communication and make the financial institutions feel more comfortable with their ability to provide the services. We did look at descheduling and whether or not pushing descheduling would, or rescheduling to like a schedule two or something less on the absolutely prohibited, no health benefits whatsoever. That really doesn't work so well for recreational programs since it relies upon an actual prescription. It's also something that, as Ms. Mack had said, the DEA looked at and said, no, we don't have any proof that this is necessary, so we're not going to do it right now. We also looked at the viability of a state or dedicated financial institution that would be able to specifically take the accounts, but that runs afoul of the dual regulation between the federal government and the state government, and they would still be subject to federal deposit insurance, and then they would still be subject to the Federal Reserve Board's master account program. There was a credit union out of Colorado who had pushed a lawsuit. One of the things they couldn't get was access to a master account, which allows them to essentially do modern banking business with the electronic transfers of funds between individual accounts. And in that case, the federal judge basically had to come out and say, I can't make them do something that's illegal, and until you get federal action, there's nothing we can do here, and so that case was dismissed. The committee had felt that the same would be the result of a dedicated financial institution in Oregon as well.
So with that, I think, keeping in mind that there is significant pain points on a financial institution if they run afoul with federal regulators, both the master account, their deposit insurance, which is required, and also the supervision of typically we're in a bank with or a credit union with a federal examiner who is applying federal law. And so, what we have proposed really is trying to assist banks in being a little more comfortable in working through the current system with the understanding, of course, that we still are living in uncertain times and we could definitely see even changes to that. So I think with that, I'll close. And we can take any questions from the committee.
Thank you very much. Questions on this issue? My sense of it, given what you've said, is that you have pretty well exhausted the different possibilities for moving immediately. Is that your sense of it as well?
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. We explored options, even the state bank, which has constitutional issues on top of the federal overlay. We just are having difficulty finding a place that provides the level of certainty. So, mm-hmm.
Thank you. Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. I want to just explore a little bit the idea of a state bank. What are the exact hurdles, or what happens if we didn't call it a state bank, we called it a state depository or something equivalent? This is a big problem. I mean, mm-hmm. There is cash sitting all over the state in unsafe places. It is a source of a lot of stress for these new businesses. It puts them at a security risk. It's a problem that needs to be solved.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler. Yeah, I mean, of course, I think we share everyone's concerns that the large amounts of cash is definitely an issue. However, a state bank would be, I think, at best questionable constitutionality under the Oregon Constitution. Mm-hmm. And then, as Aaron had mentioned, even if one reached over that hurdle, you'd still have the master account, which would be an issue. An institution wouldn't be able to do any sort of modern banking, essentially. Remitting tax payments to revenue electronically would be essentially out of the question. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't really net you anything more than what we've got now. So,
can I follow up? Mm-hmm. They would offer security, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, Chair Barnhart and Representative Buehler, institutions now can offer that same security as long as they've done their diligence, as long as they've asked the right questions of the people depositing those funds and followed the dictates of the Cole memo and other other guidance and expectations from FinCEN.
Not functionally, though, there's only, I mean, how many financial institutions are willing to take that on in Oregon right now?
Representative Barnhart, or Chair Barnhart, and Representative Bueller, there are three institutions total that we're aware of, which is proportional to the other states that have marijuana regulation as well.
And do you think that's providing adequate banking services for the industry?
Representative, our Chair Barnhart, Rep. Bueller, I'm going to have Aaron, I think, chime in if she wants. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller. One of the things that we learned when we were talking with Colorado and Washington in particular is that they have about 5% of their banks and 10% of their credit unions providing services in this area. They also had fully operational licensing and tracking systems before they began their programs. And so the financial institutions in those two states already had a regulatory baseline to be able to track and make sure that the people, that their licensees, the retailers, the growers, were following the requirements of the Cole memo. So one of the things that they had mentioned is that they think they probably have between 60% and 75% of their industry banked, but they can do it with 5%. It's just a matter of making sure that those financial institutions are comfortable. Since Oregon is just kind of coming out of a transition period where we didn't have those full licensing and tracking provisions in place, it's possible that we will see an uptick and that the 5% to 10% that has served essentially 60% to 75% of Colorado and Washington's will also be sufficient to serve in Oregon once they're able to rely on the licensing information that's shared with them and tracking information to make sure that their enhanced due diligence is supplemented by regulatory due diligence. So it is possible that once they become more comfortable with the level of due diligence that we could serve a majority of the industry with the number of banks and credit unions that we have now willing to enter the game. Does that help with your question at all?
Let me just paraphrase. So Washington, Colorado, you feel has been having a longer lead time with this. They have 60% of the industry covered, but you think Oregon will eventually get to that same level as Washington, Colorado? And if so, that's only 60%. What about those other 40% that's out there?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, part of that takes into account businesses that are not interested in banking. While it is a security issue, there are also certain cultural norms that some business owners are going to take with them and not want to bank. Some, since we're moving from a gray or an illegal area to gray to fully legal, some people, based on their background, will just never be able to get an account. So it's possible we could do more than 60, but it's unlikely that we'll ever be able to bank 100% of the industry. And it's probably that the industry won't be interested in 100% being banked.
Chair Barnhart, I'd be very interested in hearing from the industry itself with regards to this issue, if possible, at some point.
Let's see if we can arrange something. They're not here today, but I think that's something that we could look into. One of the things to be aware of is that we are straying from the charge of the committee. It may be something that ought to be considered by the committees that deal with business and or government systems, rather than the Revenue Committee. But I think I think you're right that it's a useful issue to look into, and I'm assuming that the Joint Committee on Marijuana is looking into this issue as well, aren't they? Does anyone know?
Chair Barnhart, not to our knowledge, at least.
They don't think so, and Mazin, who works with them, doesn't think so. But I think it is a useful thing to look into. I will say that several years ago, we looked carefully into the idea of establishing a state bank for a different reason, and we reached the same conclusions that you're hearing today about that issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this bill was championed by now State Treasurer
Tobias Reid,
Representative then Tobias Reid, and he wanted to resolve and look into these issues.
Right.
So it's
all right. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony today and the thorough job it sounds like you've done trying to figure out how to deal with this dilemma.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And both the report, the full report and the executive summary are in OLIS for you. If you
They're in OLIS for you to look at. Yes. Thank you. And with that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2203. Mazin, you're going to describe that to us, and there is an amendment which has been proposed. I think most of the testimony is probably connected with the original bill, but I think we ought to describe both, if you would, please.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2203 basically changes the distribution, the tax distribution that you have seen presented here when Department of Revenue and Deanna Mack was presenting. This, it is also in your background of the measure description. The distribution primarily goes to 40% common school fund, 20% mental health account, 15% state police, and then 10% each to cities and counties. This bill, by what it tends to do, is changes this distribution mechanism and primarily takes out the 40% that goes to school and increases the amounts that go to cities and counties to 30% each. Now, it also changes the amount going to OHA, so that brings back the 100% altogether. So that's where you see all the taking out of the old language and putting in the new language into the bill. Now that's the bill as 2203 tries to do. Now the amendment, what it does, it goes back to the original distribution language of all the same type of percentage that is allocated through the distribution that was in the original law or current law, if you will. However, it changes two things. It changes the common school fund distribution, the 40%, and puts it, allows it to go to the state school fund. This is part of the issue that the budget discussions and so on, everybody seems to agree that this is what the original intent was for the schools to be receiving that today, rather than the Common School Fund, which works as an endowment.
Now, when you say original intent, you're referring to the initiative.
Right.
Thank you.
And then the second issue that the amendment attempts to do is to fix the issue or the problem that also Department of Revenue talked about, the distribution, which is leaving the distributions to cities and counties at a later time that is inadvertently gets to be governed by the new way of distributing, which is based on the number of businesses in a county or a city rather than the locality. So that basically says this is doesn't matter when you distribute. What actually needs to be done is all the money is collected before July is distributed on the per capita as the first year was required first. So it tries to fix that that problem, and then of course goes back to having the second year with the new definitions based on the number of businesses in that locality. That's what the amendment, the dash one, does.
Okay, so if I understand what you've just said correctly, it deals with the problem of timing that we heard from the Department of Revenue, and meets with what we think the intent of the original initiative was, and then it restores the intent of the original initiative after that, including fixing the likely error in the reference to the Common School Fund and instead of putting it in the endowment fund, then moves it to the operating fund instead, the state school fund. Did I get that correct?
The state school fund issue is correct, Mr. Chair. It actually moves it to the state school fund, which is the amount that could be appropriated now. That we believe the original intent. Mm-hmm. The issue about the distribution, this happened in the joint committee. The joint committee, as a result of the different arrangements that were put together, allowed for local government or cities or counties to opt out. And part of the idea of the cities or the counties that opt out probably need not kind of share with the revenue that they're opting out from. So, however, in order to go with this issue in a resolution, what they assumed is the first year's revenues, let's keep them as they are based on population. So everybody gets a share of that based on the population.
It's a transition time.
Right. The second year, you get it based on the amount of businesses that you licensed in your locality, either the city or the county. So if you have...
Which is the formula in the existing law that we can't apply to the first year because of the transition problem, as described by the Department of Revenue.
That's right.
Okay. Is that clear as mud to anybody besides me? Okay. I think we've got enough... So we can go on to the witnesses, and I see that Representative Wilson is here. I assume you are here because you'd like to be heard.
Yes, sir.
Please come forward. And do you have some people you want to join you? Or?
Yes, if I could have Rob Bovet with me.
Bovet.
Chair Barnhart and members, for the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass, Cave Junction, and the heart of Josephine County. Pleasure being here today. I thought I was just speaking on a nice little simple bill today, but I just found out it sounds a bit more complicated. I want to talk about the base bill. I'm here to talk about 2203 today, a bill that would make substantial changes in the eventual distribution of marijuana tax revenue. This comes to you as a committee bill, but for the record, I requested that this bill be crafted, and I appreciate the able assistant of AOC's Rob Bovet, who is here today. Key component to this bill is that it directs a larger portion of the revenue generated through the taxation of retail marijuana to cities and to counties. Furthermore, it adjusts the metric that is used to calculate portions of the tax revenue allocated to local jurisdictions, to include and consider grow site canopy areas. Please remember that. This means those communities which have experienced changes accompanying large-scale outdoor commercial marijuana cultivation and production will have the resources to mitigate some of the impacts caused by this upheaval. The reason I've offered the bill today is really straightforward. My district, which is historically a natural resource-dependent community, lies in the heart of the finest outdoor cannabis growing region in the entire state. Josephine County is home to proportionately, or I should say disproportionately, large numbers of medical marijuana grow sites. In fact, I think we have close to 3,000 in my district alone. And increasingly, OLC licensed cannabis farms are growing in number as well. We've seen a tremendous growth in canopy acres and an influx of fortune seekers. And with all of this comes social pressures on neighborhoods, economic pressure on real estate prices, rental availability, and demand for public safety services and code enforcement in our county, as we're ill-prepared to manage the current situation. At one time, as most of you know, timber delivered the money to our community. Not so any longer. Cannabis may be a ways away from replacing the timber, but it is gaining quick significance in our cities, counties, and communities, and we need to be able to benefit from this resource. We're never going to be able to benefit if it's tied strictly to retail outlets. So I thank you for your consideration today. I hope I can count on the committee to look favorably on the principles behind House Bill 2203. Thank you.
Mr. Bovet.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Had the pleasure over the past two sessions of working closely with Representative Wilson, a member of the Joint Marijuana Committee, on essentially tuning up Measure 91 and the OMMP. Three real quick things, and I'll just make very quick comments about the bill itself. First off, I should say I stand ready to work with any work group to do necessary amendments to both 2203 and 2204. Both of them need amendments, and I'll speak to that in a moment. But to answer a couple of the questions that were lingering that are not directly related to this bill, you should know that we've seen a dramatic decrease in the number of OMMP, medical marijuana, patient cardholders in the state of Oregon over the last year, dropped by about 10,000, was 77,000 a year ago, now it's 67,000, just to answer that question that was kind of lingering. The second question that was lingering, the OLCC does not enforce the time, place, and manner regulations for cities or counties. We have to do that. We can turn over a final adjudicated judgment to them. Mm-hmm. They can use to sanction their folks, but we have to do all of that. So that's just one of the many burdens that have been placed upon cities and counties that really is not funded, which leads to this bill and 2204. 2203, I need to let you know, I crafted it prior to the November election. So, yes, I did, in fact, take that 40% to the Common School Fund and eliminate it and give it to cities and counties. I recognize that the political and economic realities are different today, but we wanted to provide the vehicle with which we need to address and really fix the Measure 91 tax distribution formula, which neither of the two prior legislative sessions dealt with because we basically punted it to you. So the Dash 1 amendments would actually fix many of the technical problems with that distribution formula, but would not fix the policy problems with the formula that Representative Wilson has explained. So I think the Dash 1 amendments are a good start to 2203, but we need to sit down and we actually need to make the language, specifically the distributions to cities and counties, actually work and function and get the money where it needs to go based on impact and allow counties and cities to use it for really dealing with the impacts, which the language currently does not allow. So we need to make more changes. Dash ones are a good start. We need to take into consideration some of the policy ramifications that Representative Wilson made. And I'm happy to talk about 2204 as well, but you probably don't want me to do that yet.
Not right yet. I have one question for you, and that is, are you bringing the amendment that you have suggested is needed for the committee's consideration later?
Chair Barnhart, I am more than happy to do that. I think what I need to do, however, is sit down with a few stakeholders. So I need to make sure that the language that I write up for the cities is acceptable to LOC. And so there's a number of stakeholders that have a kind of a role.
Right. I mean, I appreciate your comment that the world has changed since the election. One of the concerns I had about the bill, and still do, is that the what I consider to be the intent of the drafters and the intent of the voters of the initiative to distribute significant portions of the funds to the schools. I think they erred in the way they did it, but their intent was to distribute the funds to the schools. I'm assuming that whatever you come up with will restore that piece of it for the committee's consideration.
Chair Barnhart, I think that is, in fact, the direction I've been given. So that will be a component of it as well. But keep in mind, we did dramatically change the way marijuana taxes are imposed. The Measure 91 plan was repealed and replaced with a sales tax. That creates the need, in my opinion, for amendments to 2204 to address secondary implications, but I know it's not time for that
and
yet.
And we'll deal with that shortly. Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out your comment about the medical marijuana licenses going down so significantly. Since earlier in this session, I pointed out how the purchase rates of medical marijuana have gone up significantly. I find it quite striking, and there's not been any particular resolution about the why, But I got to say, the combination of the increase with that and the decrease with the licenses mm-hmm. makes me wonder even more how much of that is a tax avoidance situation. Mm-hmm. I'm a believer in the medicinal. I've talked to many people about the medicinal uses overall, and I understand that whole premise. And at the same time, those numbers are wildly suspicious looking.
And that's not really germane to this particular bill. I would like to consider the question, but I think that given the press of time and the fact that I see that some of those who'd like to be heard on the next bill are here. Are there any questions directly germane to the bill now, recognizing the fact that we've basically been told we don't have the thing that's going to fix this bill in front of us yet?
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2203. I noticed the witness sheet is incorrect here, the way it's written. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2204. Mm-hmm. Would you give us a brief explanation? And then I think we have a couple of senators who want to be heard today. Could you come to the podium or to the witness chair for that? Give us the brief on it, and then we'll hear from the senators.
Chair Von Hart and members of the committee, the House Bill 2204 is allows the local option in the taxation issue. Today we allow local governments and the basically cities and counties that to tax marijuana at 3%, providing that the populace or the electors have approved that. This bill allows the cities or counties to push it that limit to up to 8% without necessarily going to election.
Back to a vote. All right. Thank you. Welcome. Welcome to the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a joy to be back in revenue. I miss it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which is Tigard and parts of West Portland. I'm here today with my Tigard mayor, John Cook, who will testify very briefly after Senator Ferrioli. I invited him at the last minute, so you won't see him on OLIS. I wanted to surprise him. So House Bill 2204, as Mazin said, will change the statutory limit on local government's authority to impose tax on the retail sale of marijuana. And currently, as you know, Oregon law allows a local tax of up to 3%. This would just add 5% to that. An 8% increase locally determined by local governments would allow for a composite tax of 25% when you add it to the 17% overall tax, which maintains parity with the early start period where we saw a temporary tax of 25%. Under that tax system, early start revenues were above $60 million, which exceeded expectations. Right now, 16 counties and 73 cities prohibit licensed recreational marijuana retailers as a result of elections this past November. But at the same time, all 111 local marijuana tax measures in the 2016 general election passed by substantial margins, typically in the 70s. At a composite 25% tax rate, Oregon would still have lower marijuana taxes than either Washington's 37% tax or Colorado's 27.9% tax. Furthermore, Washington and Colorado taxes are also can also be augmented by local taxes. Oregon's relatively low marijuana tax was created to discourage diversion into the black market. House Bill 2204 will preserve comparatively low taxes and assist in raising revenue to support vital services provided by local governments across Oregon. And for that reason, I strongly urge your support for House Bill 2204. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Farioli, thank you for coming today.
Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the House Revenue Committee, it's unusual that two former revenue chairs and a current revenue chair would be in the same room at the same time, but here we all are.
We avoid that carefully, don't we?
I can understand that, Mr. Chair. As my colleague far to my left said earlier, Early Start was an inspiration because we found that folks had voted themselves the authority and the right to consume cannabis recreationally, but they had no source and supply. And if we were to proceed according to the Cole Memorandum, which delineates how it is that states may authorize cannabis use, we had to control it carefully and regulate it carefully, and we needed then to have a place where people could obtain a legal supply by way of discouraging the black market. That was a goal we shared and a requirement of the Cole Memorandum. So we went to Early Start, and frankly we didn't know what to charge in terms of tax revenue. So, you know, without any sort of organizational structure, we just picked a number out of the air, and it was 25%. And that was a fortuitous number because the sales of cannabis in the first year exceeded our expectations by a couple of 100% and produced about $60 million in revenue. As the system matured and more regulations and more compliance became features, we went to a opt-in, opt-out system where a member of jurisdictions who wanted to participate did so. And we wanted to make sure that there was a little incentive for the local jurisdictions because they would have to deal with the inevitable issues with this new recreational form. So we left a little room in there, 3%. And we ultimately went to 17% state tax, 3% local tax. The folks that were purchasing cannabis with the Early Start, if there was any reaction to the reduction at the retail level because of the lower tax rate, I never noticed it. If there was a reaction, I would characterize it as, what? I mean, if you have a differential of several percentage points on any taxes, and trust me, your email basket's going to fill up on the inside. Emails, taxes, lots of them. Didn't get a word. The point is, and I think this is a term that that your able staff probably has inculcated in you in your duties as legislative revenue, elasticity. I will tell you that it's my belief that the ability for people to obtain cannabis, not in a back alley and not with a skeevy dealer, contributes to the elasticity, and they will gladly pay 25%. They won't, I don't even think they'll notice. So I guess the point is, you know, it's not very Republican of me to sit here and advocate for a higher tax. But I will tell you that the demand curve is incalculable. We don't know where the industry will go. The increase from 3 to 8% will not be a barrier to the increase in commerce. I don't believe there'll be an outcry from the consumers. The medical community is protected from the tax period, increase or otherwise. So I'm offering you an historic opportunity as members of the Revenue Committee to vote without the loss of sleep and with no fear of retribution on a tax increase. It'll never happen again. This is your golden opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair and committee. Thanks for inviting me to speak, Senator Burdick. So, as Tigard, we are...
And would you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry, John Cook, the mayor of Tigard.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We support this at the city of Tigard. Going back
to when it passed. Myself, I actually voted for or against the measure originally, and so I was not for passing it statewide. But as any other good politician, the will of the people voted for it in our city, and therefore I took it upon myself and the rest of the council, we pushed it forward. So we put forth time, place, and manner operations as did it most of the other cities. But unlike some of the cities, we decided not to try and ban everything. It's like the people voted for it, the people wanted it. But at the same time, I've heard some other cities talk to me about, well, this 3%, that's not enough for me to even pay my police overtime, let alone hire a new officer. And so from that standpoint, they didn't see that as enough to get them to want to do it. And so at the same point, I was talking to some of the retailers we have, and they're like, well, the 25 versus the 20 didn't make any difference in sales for us. The 25 was fine with the people. The 25 would be fine now. And so from that standpoint, it was interesting. I was on an LOC tour last year, and we stood out in the lobby and we toured one of the facilities. So we started questioning the people that came in, and we asked them, you know, is it 25%, 20%, 30%? Does the tax matter to you? And they said, I don't even know what the tax is, and no, it doesn't matter. And so everybody that walked in the door really didn't know the answer to that. It's sort of like if you talk about gas tax, nobody can tell you what the state, city, or county gas tax is at the pump. They might know what the total is, but they don't know what any integral part is. They buy the gas based upon the price or based upon they want that service. So changing it from 3 to 8, I don't think is that important. I think it's more of what the cities will get out of it. But like anything else, I understood the question from before is, I know maybe the intent of the people that voted for it thought it would be for education. I know that it would be really easy for somebody to sit here and say, well, why don't we take that extra 5% and put it towards education? What I'm telling you is I don't think you're going to get the cities to buy on, and the cities that she talked about in the counties that are avoiding this, unless they actually get something more that makes them want to step into this arena. And if they can't afford to police it or patrol it, they need a reason to want to do that. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. I'll point out to the committee that there is no committee at 3 o'clock. We're going to run a few minutes long. I have three people on these two bills who've come more than 100 miles, and we're going to hear them this afternoon. Are there questions for this panel? Wow, you won them on without any. Oh, there is one over here. There's always one. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For any one of you, I just wondered what consideration, if any, might be given to the propensity for certain municipalities to facilitate the siting of more retail establishments just for the sake of garnering that extra bit of taxation you talked about, because in certain communities, and I have one in my district, some of my constituents would say that they're not enthralled with the number of establishments we have for the size of the communities we have, and it's led to a bit of a backlash from those who originally approved of, you know, legalizing, saying we didn't. We thought we might have one or two in town, not six. So was that given any consideration as you talk about giving more latitude to the local entities for raising taxes on this product?
Mr. Chair, the question illustrates that the town has more than 6,000 feet of linear space, because they can't be located closer than 1,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
There is market saturation. We believe there'll be a lot of vertical integration and a lot of consolidation. So there may be a tendency for municipalities to want to license a lot of facilities. I don't necessarily think that they can do a straight math equation about if four facilities gives us X income, then six facilities will give us one, you know, the multiplier. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But I can tell you, the folks that are in the industry as growers or processors or retailers are telling me, I have no reason to doubt that, they cannot yet calculate what the total market will be in Oregon. The fastest growing demographic for users of cannabis are us. And what I mean, not legislators. Although some people may look at the product of the building and assume that that's the case. It's folks in our cohort for aches, pains, and all the stuff you'd take Geritol for, neuritis, neuralgia, joint pain. So at the end of the day, I don't think you're going to see more of a revenue stream from municipalities based on more outlets. Eventually, the market for the product will be saturated. The proof will also come knowing that Oregonians in every county, even the opt-out counties, can grow up to four plants so they can produce their own product. I think that's puts at least a potential upper limit on how much demand there'll be in the retail market.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your coming down the stairs and not very far across the hall to see us today, and welcome back
to
Revenue.
I noticed a definite downward tilt in the floor that was
perceptual.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, we do know which way the water flowed when the governor's office burned. And with that, colleagues, I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 2204 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2203 and ask Lily Morgan and Sheriff Dave Daniel from Josephine County, who indicated they're more than 100 miles from home, to come and present their testimony on House Bill 2203. Welcome, and thank you for waiting.
Thank you very much, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. I am Lily Morgan, Josephine County Commissioner, and personally, thank you, Representative Marsh, for representing Southern Oregon. We're both graduates of Southern Oregon University's Master in Management program, so thank you. Today, we are here to, or I am here, to show support of both 2203 and 2204. And coming from a different perspective, I have spent the last year campaigning for this office. I started in January learning about an industry I was not familiar with before. My former life, I was a parole officer, and so I've only dealt with the enforcement side from a legal standpoint and helping people with addictions remove barriers so they can improve their lives. But in the course of the last year, Representative Wilson challenged me to see the other side of what cannabis is. And what I've come to see, that even though Measure 91 failed in Josephine County by two votes, it is a legal product, and did you know that? It actually failed in Josephine County. It is nothing new to Josephine County to grow good cannabis. What is new to us is the unanticipated outcomes of having our market inundated with out-of-state purchasers and out-of-state land buyers. For instance, one example will be an outfit out of Jackson, Wyoming, that has applied for permits through our community development department. They have purchased 26 properties equaling 1,350 acres, of which they are leasing all of those properties out of state persons. It is safe to assume, as the concerns were expressed earlier by this committee, that the majority of our product that we're producing is going out of state. I spoke with Senator Linthicum from Klamath and Lake Counties, and they're dealing overwhelmingly with the trafficking of this product going out of the state and the impact on their community. But from our community, we have seen an attack on our culture from small communities that have taken care of themselves, even with a lack of law enforcement. They still are community-minded, and we do really care for our neighbors. But all of a sudden, it's not our neighbors we're dealing with. We're dealing with people from out of state who are not having a concern about the impact. Because of the cash industry, we're seeing money laundering and illegal, basically harassment and intimidation by cartel and out-of-state persons as well, trying to hone in on the revenues. I see this as an opportunity for Josephine County, and the reason I support 2203 is Josephine County grows some of the best stuff in the state, literally. Now, I'm also coming from someone who's never used it before, so I'm taking other people's word for it.
We appreciate that clarification.
Thank you.
It's still legal. You don't have to make that remark anymore.
Well, it has been an interesting exposure, as I've had family members facing cancer lately who are using RSOs and other things to face this battle. And I have many cousins that work in the dispensaries and grow industry. Matter of fact, some family members just today in Grants Pass have legal recreational grow sites, started in a retail shop in Jackson County, because the retail is so, I'm sorry, because the real estate is so competitive in Josephine County right now, you will have people show up and offer cash 20% above asking value. A normal person cannot get a job unless you have the financial backing behind the You cannot get housing. You cannot get real estate property unless you have the cash backing right now because you cannot compete. Josephine County is a hardworking and proud community, and we want to take care of ourselves. But one of the things that House Bill 2203 fixes is the canopy recreational rows are not currently included in the revenue stream to the state. We are deeply impacted by being the producer to the rest of the state. I had another commissioner tell me that when he was a small business owner, there's two things that he took care of. First, the family of his employees. He took care of his employees, and the next most important thing he took care of was his suppliers, because without his suppliers, he couldn't keep customers satisfied. And in order to keep customers satisfied, his employees and suppliers had to do that. Josephine and Jackson counties represent over a third of the registered grows in the state currently. We are your suppliers for your best products that you are offering. We're the only, for the most part, outdoor, other than Lane County has some outdoor. We are the majority of the outdoor grows, but that is currently an underutilized revenue stream. Believe it or not, we have people who want to continue to show the legitimacy of the marijuana cannabis industry, and they want to be a part of the solutions that Josephine County are facing. I have had several growers come to me and say, tax us. How can we help be a part of the solution? But the current system does not allow for that to happen through the grows. And this correction would be allowed through House Bill 2203, which would be beneficial to us. We currently have over 500 complaints through our community development on code enforcement. Because the OLCC and the OHA are not enforcing the regulations that have been imposed on the local governments locally, there's nobody to enforce if you're not licensed. And we have, with over 3,000 medical grows.
And if you would move it right along, we're rapidly running out of time, and I have another witness after the two of you.
Absolutely.
Who's also come more than 100 miles. I take it from what you've said so far is that you like 2203.
That is a great summary. Okay. We think that it would allow the side of the industry not being represented to be able to be brought into more revenue into the state.
And I want to say that I do appreciate, and I think the committee appreciates, understanding the issues that lead you to support the bill.
Thank you
very much. Sheriff, would you like to present?
Chairman Barnhart, thank you, and members of the committee. I'll make it very quick. How's that sound?
And for the record, you are?
Sheriff Dave Daniel, Josephine County. Thank you, sir. And Commissioner Morgan covered it very well, very, very thoroughly. At the end of the day, though, I want to thank you all and appreciate the fact that you're starting to see some of the problems in the banking. And such, you know, the streamline of where this stuff's going, and is it too much, or are we growing too much, and that sort of a thing. You're right. You're right on spot. And I'm living it, is unfortunately the problem. I've been living in it for about a year and a half, 2 years now, with all the trouble that's come our way. We call them trimmigrants. Trimmigrants are those that have come in and work for a little bit for $20 an hour, trim the stuff off, and then leave. Three homicides in the last year and a half, directly related to the industry of marijuana and its cultivation. All of these individuals were from outside the state of Oregon, Kentucky, Florida, Utah, New Jersey, Arizona, Texas. And so this industry, this Measure 91, has brought maybe some prosperity to our state in a certain way, but it's not funding me. The OLCC, God bless them, they're overwhelmed. They can't keep up with this. OHA, no way. They can't keep up with this. So where does the buck stop? Where does it fall? It falls on the counties, and it falls directly, unfortunately, in my lap. And so I get to deal with the unfortunate fallout. I'll stop there. I think I've probably said enough, and we can move forward. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We very much appreciate hearing from you today. I want to let you know that we will be holding over the hearing on House Bill 2203 till tomorrow, and I think the rest of the witnesses that I have on the list are people who are regularly here. So we'll hold this one over until tomorrow, and so we'll temporarily close the hearing on House Bill 2203, and I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2204. And I'm going to call Hunter, is it Niebauer?
That's correct.
Who also indicates he's more than 100 miles from home. Please come forward and give your testimony on House Bill 2204. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Hunter Niebauer. I own Oregrown Industries, and we are a vertically integrated cannabis company out of Bend, Oregon. I am also the chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Cannabis Association, and I'm here to testify in opposition of 2204. I am not here to testify against taxation. I am here to urge you to allow our young industry to gain its footing and become an industry we all want in Oregon, one that is safe, law-abiding, and as a result, contributing to public services around the state. In the past 2 years, a great deal of progress has been made in bringing more and more cannabis into the legal system that has been set up by the legislature. However, we know that a great deal more can be done to achieve a 100% legal industry. And our fear is that overregulation and an early increase in revenue rates will reverse the progress we have made. By raising the tax, we are increasing the cost to the end consumer, which makes it difficult for the industry to compete with the illegal market. The state will capture more revenue if the cost to the end consumer is competitive with the illegal market, not more expensive. I have submitted 3 documents to give a broad overview of the market landscape, both here and in Colorado. Colorado has been extremely successful in capturing a majority of the illegal market. Oregonians have traditionally had the ability to purchase cannabis products at a much lower price than anywhere else in the country due to a thriving medical and illegal market. According to a document put together by the OLCC, in 2017, Oregon is projected to lose $300 million in marijuana sales, illegal marijuana sales, and $51 million in tax revenue. With lower tax rates, the legal system will have the ability to make cannabis products available at a historically consistent price point. I understand how challenged state and local resources are at this time in Oregon, and I appreciate the desire to solve those challenges. The membership of the OCA wants to be a part of that solution now and in the future. But we can only be a part of the solution by ensuring that we are on the path to a 100% legal industry. The closer we get to that goal, the more revenue comes to Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Niebauer? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Again, I'm going to hold over the hearing till tomorrow on House Bill 2204 in the event that there are others who are on the list who would like to testify tomorrow. And with that, we'll close the public hearing. Paul?
Tomorrow
morning, 8:30. We'll be the guests of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and we're meeting here in this room. All right? That's the announcement. Thank you so much for staying late. With that, the committee is adjourned.